Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today I think we're going to be talking about, well, one of the most exciting new products I've encountered in a long time.
Yeah, the clue to this week's program is everything tastes good.
Oh, doesn't
even,
it?
Even if you buy it at the store, if you make it yourself based on a cookbook, what's the other one in there? If you order it all the way from Hawaii, you're going to be delighted because it's all going to taste delicious. And at the start, as Anne was saying, one of the most fascinating and delightfully tasty products that's crossed our doorstep in a long time.
Yes. Let's hear from David Barber. And well, I don't know if everybody has been living in some kind of obscure cave and doesn't know about Blue Hill, because Blue Hill's everywhere. People love the country place as well as the city place. We're talking to David Barber. You're the co-founder, are you, David?
Yeah, I'm a co-founder and co-owner, yes.
Co-founder and co-owner of Blue Hill Farm?
Blue Hill Farm and Blue Hill Restaurants.
Okay.
Now Blue Hill Yogurt.
And now Blue Hill Yogurt. Is this your first product, huh?
It's our first commercial product. We run a small cafe on one of the restaurant sites on the farm property, and we've used that cafe as a bit of a product laboratory to test out ideas. And the yogurts began both there and in the restaurant. And so this is the first one that we've taken to sort of national distribution.
Okay, but let's back up and talk about where is this? What is it, Blue Hill Farm?
Well, Blue Hill Farm, the original farm, is in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, in the Berkshires, and it belonged to our grandmother. And my brother and I chose to name our business after it because we were very connected to that particular farm and to our childhood memories of growing up there and working in agriculture in the Berkshires in the 70s. We opened Blue Hill, New York in 1999, and that was our first restaurant, and then 5 years later, simultaneously helped open the Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture just outside of Tarrytown, New York. And on that campus, we installed a second Blue Hill restaurant in one of the old dairy barns.
Right. And so it was the old Rockefeller estate?
Correct. It was a dairy complex that was built in the 1920s that used to service the main Rockefeller country estate up there. And the estate is part of the estate itself. The original house is part of the National Historic Trust, but the Stone Barns complex, the dairy farm complex, had remained in private hands, in David Rockefeller's hands, until the creation of this agricultural center, at which point he donated very generously the land and the building to this new effort. So the Stone Barns is now a separate 501c3 charitable organization that focuses on educating the public and farmers on the future of agriculture.
Blue Hill at Stone Barns is their tenant, is a tenant.
We are. We are the primary tenant on the property, and we're also the primary customer of the farm.
But you don't actually run the farm, or you do run the farm?
No, we don't run the farm. I mean, okay. We work obviously very closely with them, and we helped set it up when it was originally opened. But the Stone Barn Center has evolved quite independently or together with us and is now a nonprofit unto its own with its own executive director and management that's running both the farm and education programs.
But
Dan and I sit on the board, but the relationship with the restaurant, for a whole bunch of reasons, has some arm's length qualities to it, meaning that we pay real rent for the spaces that we occupy, and we pay real money for the food that we use off the farm in the restaurant.
But you have a fairly important influence on the fact of what it is that the farm is going to produce and the quality of it, correct?
Yes and no. I mean, our influence is based on our support, which is that we have an agreement, not really a written thing, but more of a spiritual agreement, that we will purchase anything that farm produces. And we are there primarily to help that farm move agriculture forward and allow it to grow the kind of things that we think should be grown in the way that they're grown in the future. And so it's really the farm that's influencing what we're serving in the restaurant, because we're taking whatever they're producing and figuring out a way to make it work for us and for our customers. It's one of the reasons there are no menus at that particular restaurant, because it'd be a little bit too difficult to run it on a day-to-day basis if we were having people choose what they're eating. So people have to come to the restaurant with the notion that they're going to the experience and sort of accept what's been harvested that week or even that day.
And it's not just crops, it's animals as well, correct?
Yes, there are two significant farming operations there, one vegetable and one animal.
Is this where the milk comes from?
No, that's where it gets a little confusing. The milk actually comes from the original Blue Hill Farm up in Massachusetts. So the only thing that the Stone Barns doesn't do is dairy, and we do dairy at my old grandmother's place.
Oh, I see, okay.
In Western Mass.
Okay, but the reason that prompted this particular discussion at this time was this product, which is taken to market by storm, I think you would say, comes in black containers, and it's wonderful, wonderful yogurt. And how did this come about for this specific style of a food product?
Well, we were looking for things to do that we could bring to market that were consistent with who we are. And from a food perspective, that has a lot to do with integrity of ingredients and the provenance of where they're sourced from. So anything that we try and develop, you know, sort of fits those general criteria. Yogurt was particularly interesting because we do have a dairy that we own, and so we're actively looking for ways to use the milk. But it was also a food product category that ironically allowed us to do many of the things that we want to do in the creation of a product without having to make unfortunate compromises in order to bring it to a wider audience. So there are no preservatives or odd chemicals or any of the things you typically find in industrial food added to the yogurt. So we found something that we could stand 100% behind in terms of the integrity of what's in the cup. And then the idea for the vegetables started with my brother kind of playing with that in the kitchen and serving it to customers in the restaurant as part of their meals, more of condiments and partial portions of dishes. People really loved it, particularly the beet.
The beet is wonderful.
That gave us this idea that we could enter the yogurt marketplace with something that really hadn't been done before in the form of a savory yogurt that was devoted exclusively to vegetables.
Yeah, I mean, that's really rather brilliant. But of course, I guess we should expect that of David and Dan Barber, since they are a couple of pretty brilliant guys anyway.
I don't know about that, but my brother's certainly brilliant. And, you know, it was sort of there. So we figured we didn't have any market research, so to speak, other than the positive response we had had from our own customers. But we had a willing partner in Whole Foods to help us get off the ground, tried to make the packaging and the story as distinct as possible so people would know the difference. But the business side of it is interesting to me. The yogurt, as fast as it's grown, and, you know, Greek has started to dominate the market. As a country, we still eat per capita about one-third the volume of yogurt that Europeans eat. So there seems like there's plenty of room for innovation and new ideas, and this focus on sweet yogurts and fruit-based yogurts, I think, can be expanded quite broadly because people want to eat yogurt at all times of day. And personally, as I've been spending more time, you know, eating yogurt the last couple of years, your preferences evolve quite quickly. I don't find myself craving or even thinking about having sweet blueberry yogurt at 3
o'clock. No, see, I've always hated that. I've hated that, but I love not only that your yogurts are not dead sweet, but also that they have a stronger connection to the earth when you're dealing with things such as beets. And they're perfectly balanced. You have the perfect balance of sweet and acidity in each one of these, which is a real trick.
Thank you. Yeah, it wasn't easy to achieve that balance and maintain it at the production. But one of the reasons that happens is because these yogurts contain a very large percentage of actual vegetables. I mean, the puree percentage per cup of yogurt is generally north of 25%, and in the case of beet, it's over 30%. And so you're really getting, you know, an average fruit yogurt or your customary yogurt is probably 6 to 8% puree. So you're really getting a mini meal in these cups. It's part of what drives the cost, but it also drives the flavor.
Now, David, let's make sure that everyone understands the flavors that are available. But as you do that, I think some of the flavors have other interesting things added into them. I think there's one that has honey in it. There's one that has something else in it. Can you highlight those as you sort of go through the entire portfolio?
I can highlight some. Yeah, the recipes themselves, you know, are puree mixes. They're really concentrates of different vegetable flavors with a few accents to offset them. For instance, the beet has beet vinegar in it, as a way of helping us balance the acidity of the yogurt. But we currently have 6 flavors: beet, butternut squash, sweet potato, carrot, tomato, and parsley. And they range in terms of intensity of flavor, I think, with the probably the sweet potato and the beet being on the very high end, the tomato being the most mild. On a percentage basis, the tomato is the least, mainly because the acidity of the tomatoes, if you get the percentages too high, you can't get the yogurt to set. So the tomato ended up being sort of our mildest flavor. But interestingly, people love that, particularly to cook with. People, you know, use it as a sour cream replacement. I know people who love to have tacos with it or eat baked potatoes with it.
Yeah, you have recipes.
Eat it out of the cup.
You have recipes on your website for dishes featuring these yogurts. So it's promoted as a cooking sauce as well as a snack, huh?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Blue Hill is about more broadly is all this great food that people are trying to grow is wonderful and worthy to promote, but we also have to promote people to actually cook, because if they don't cook, there's nothing to do with all these wonderful ingredients. And I think these yogurts, in fact, lend themselves quite well to being both snack or a meal replacement, but also something that can be used as an ingredient for anything from a salad dressing to a morning shake to more complicated baking recipes. So we've tried to lay out a whole suite of those for people to choose from on the website, and people are starting to send us their own in great numbers. So it's really nice to see.
Yeah. Now, what did you do before Blue Hill?
Well, I was helping Dan with his catering business in the mid-90s. So before we opened the restaurant, we were pretty much exclusively catering. But we really got going on the farm in 95. So it's been almost 20 years now that I've been focused on this for my livelihood.
Were you trained culinary-wise?
No, I'm the business guy, and I try and stay out of the kitchen as my brother's department. And he's the trained chef, and it works better when we kind of divide and conquer in that respect.
That works in every situation.
You don't want me in the kitchen.
How about a website?
The website is bluehillyogurt.com, and that really has the most detailed information on the yogurts, and then bluehillfarm.com is something more overall on the company, the farming operations, and the 2 restaurants.
Well, I really am so pleased that it's working out for you, and more praise for Daisy, I think, was the one I had today.
I think it was Daffodil.
Daffodil was yesterday.
I'm glad you're enjoying them, and we've been, genuinely thrilled with the response. And so we're hoping we have more flavors to come. And so we're hoping to expand the line and also expand our distribution somewhat so that more people can get to it.
Oh, great. What kind of, what are you working on flavor-wise?
Oh, we can't announce those just yet, but we have a lot. One of the ones, some of the flavors that we were doing originally in the restaurant, especially this time of year, were, green in nature. It's a great time for pea yogurt right about now, actually.
Oh, pea, yeah.
Peas are peaking. We had not been able, for that first round that we developed last year, we had not been able to figure out a way to get the colors that we got from the other flavors. It was part of the story, was these bright colors.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, with the green yogurts, we found that in the process of creating the yogurts, we couldn't get the green color to hold. The way a regular yogurt company would do would be to add that, add some sort of dye or something to keep the color. And we wouldn't do that. And the greens were basically a beige brown. And so it wasn't consistent with that beautiful color story that we have in the other flavors. But we think we figured out a way around that for next year.
Yeah, I'm going to.
We have a whole suite of green ideas that we hope are coming.
Well, can I nominate artichoke and eggplant?
You can nominate anyone you want. We have a long list. We're working on all of them.
David, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. And keep those yogurts coming.
Will do, Ann. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye, David.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. I don't know if you realize that I have this passion for passion fruit, but I just adore it, and I can't afford it in the United States. When we were
who can afford it?
I don't know, but anyhow, someone who can is Lori Cardenas, who's going to represent or talk to us about her company, Auntie Lily Coy, which is not how you say it, but she's going to correct us in the interview. Now, I'm probably going to say this wrong, but the product we're talking about is Auntie Lily Coy. Is this true?
That's very good.
Good.
The Hawaiians actually pronounce it Lily Coy.
Coy, okay. Yep. Lily Coy. And you are, by adoption, a Hawaiian since you were 4 years of age, Lori Cardenas. And
Yes,
and you have a whole line of passion fruit products. What made you think of this?
Well, actually, I didn't think of it. Well, maybe I should back up just a little bit. The word lili ko'i in Hawaiian is the Hawaiian word for passion fruit.
Oh, okay.
And the word auntie, we address, you know, we don't use Mr. and Mrs. here in Hawaii.
Right.
We address all of our elders as auntie and uncle. So mm-hmm. the word, you know, the name Auntie Lili Ko'i is a very, you know, it's a very beloved name here in Hawaii. And I actually purchased a business in 2001, so 13 years ago, from the original Auntie Lily Coy, who at the time was a 70-year-old man.
Oh, wow.
And when I bought the business from him, it was basically 5 product recipes and the Auntie Lily Coy trade name. And that's what I got. So we've been pretty busy for the past 13 years.
Well, look at all you have now. You have how many products? And just tell us what some of them are.
We have the original 5 products, you know, which is a jelly, a mustard, a butter, a syrup, and a dressing. And we've added, you know, expanded the line. We now make 19 different condiments. Plus, you know, I do a line of desserts. And I also have some other small businesses make passion fruit products for me, for my retail division. So I've actually lost count, but I think we're up around 50 as the number of products that are actually represented in our location.
Now, let's go back to basics here, because until I was 23 years old, I had no idea what a passion fruit was. I had never seen one in a market. I certainly had never tasted one.
Well, you tell me you're English. You were born
well,
and
yeah,
raised
I was
in
born
England.
And raised in England, and I discovered passion fruit when I got to Australia. But I'll bet there's some percentage of the population here in these United States who doesn't know what a passion fruit is. And if they do know its name, they've never seen one, and they don't know what you do with one. How about you go through those definitions for us?
Okay, well, the passion fruit is actually the fruit that grows from the passiflora, or passion flower. And there are approximately 600 different varieties of passion flower that grow. About 10% of them, so about 60 of the varieties bear edible fruit. Uh-huh. And the fruit that I use is the common yellow, the Passiflora edulis flavicarpa. That's the most common. And that is the one that is the most suitable for canning purposes because of its high acidity level. But just briefly, you know, the dried passion flowers are used in tea, and they're a natural relaxer.
Okay, so, after the passion flower has flowered, then you get this growth that's sort of about the size and same shape as a plum, sort of wrinkled on the outside.
Yeah, that's one of the varieties. The one that I use actually is about the size of a lemon, and it's got a smooth waxy rind,
and it's
yellow. Uh-huh. Yeah, so that's the variety that I use.
Is the inside
but
the
same? Some of them are wrinkled.
But on the inside are all the same with the seeds and the gel?
Yeah, you cut them open and you look at them, and it's kind of like, reminiscent of a pomegranate. You know, it's got a lot of small black seeds that are surrounded by the fruit pulp.
And they have a unique taste like nothing you've ever tasted.
Yeah, in fact, people try to, you know, get me to describe how it tastes, and I really can't, because it's very unique. It's got some citrus, undertones, but it's definitely not a citrus fruit.
And it tastes like a passion fruit.
Yeah, it sure does.
Why does it have to taste like something else?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, now, you have listed your different products. You have jellies, butters, syrups, mustards. Some people would not think of passion fruit as mustard, but we can vouch for the passion fruit wasabi mushroom, which is really wonderful.
And, you know, that's actually our best-selling product of everything in our entire product line.
Oh, really? You wouldn't think.
Yeah, I had some the other day with some leftover tongue that I fixed. I fixed three beef tongues. So we had a lot of beef tongue. We had beef tongue for several days. So I was looking for new flavor combinations to try. And there was something about the sweetness but the bitterness combined that really went very, very well. So if you're looking for something else to try to recommend, assuming that you can find people who cook beef tongue, you can say, well, it's
beef
perfect.
Beef tongue, okay. Let me keep that in mind.
Now, you also, you do sauces, and it's not surprising that based in Hawaii that you do have a lot of Asian influences in your in your recipes.
Yes, definitely.
And so you have a passion fruit wasabi teriyaki.
Uh-huh.
And then what I haven't tasted is just the pure, unadulterated passion fruit, unsweetened juice. Where can you buy that?
The juice is actually, you can drink it if you want. I would, definitely recommend adding, a little bit more water and a sweetener.
Oh, okay.
In fact, I would kind of compare that, if you go to the store and buy real lemon, reconstituted lemon juice. It's the same thing, except that this is a reconstituted passion fruit juice. Mm-hmm. So it's got the tartness, but it's actually best used in recipes, to make other things.
Well, you're really a dynamic business person because you also extend over, aside from the specialty food items, into skincare. Who knew about skincare with passion fruit? What makes it
so
wonderful?
Well, the passion, that actually is a fragrance with the passion flower. So I have a friend of mine who's been in the skincare business for over 20 years, and she created this line for me.
Uh-huh.
And she uses the essential oil from the purple passion flower, and that's what's used to fragrance the line of personal care products that we offer.
And aromatherapy with a candle?
Yeah, aromatherapy, exactly. Candles, and, we also have another friend of mine makes our soy candles and also an olive oil soap that's fragranced with passion fruit.
Where is your biggest market?
Well, probably our friends from the U.S. mainland. That's where we get the majority of our business.
Uh-huh.
We also sell quite a bit to locals, but, most of... our island is visitor driven, tourist driven. So we get quite a few visitors in our shop every day,
uh-huh.
And then most of them become repeat customers. And I've been dealing with some of some of our customers on the mainland since I started 13 years ago.
Now I'm guessing the locals aren't such good customers because they can probably pick up passion fruit anywhere they like. Right?
It's funny what they do is my products are more of a specialty line, and a lot of our locals don't buy them for themselves, but they will buy them to send to friends.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Got it. Now this is not just a nice product that we're talking about. I mean this is a prize winning class, especially the mustard. I mean, who knew that was a mustard competition? But I guess, I suppose, there must be one.
For everything.
but you've won quite a number of awards for your wasabi passion fruit mustard. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, our passion fruit wasabi mustard and our passion fruit wasabi dressing. I've gotten medals for either one or both. 10 of the past 11 years. We just missed 2006, but every year since 2004, we've gotten awards for either one or both of those products.
Now, what I think we ought to mention also is how nicely packaged you make these. So you're anticipating that they're going eventually to be gifts, huh?
Yeah, for the most part. But we just like to look, have our products. Our products are, have wonderful ingredients and they taste great. And we just, want to have them look as good as they taste.
How does somebody get some? How widely available are your products in distribution? And if people are frustrated, they can't find what stores to buy them in, can they get in touch with you and you send them?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And we have a toll-free number that that our customers can call, or we have a website as well. And We utilize the United States Postal Service for mailing, and since they introduced the flat rate box program, our products can be sent all over for a very reasonable cost. It used to be that the freight from Hawaii would scare people.
Yeah, I think that's the way ours came. Now let's spell the website name out slowly, because it's got a lot of L's in it.
Yes, it does. it's actually www.auntielilykoi.com, and that's AUNTYLILIKOI.com.
Sort of like Mississippi.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the products are delightful, and I think that you're a very forward-thinking businesswoman, and I congratulate you on that and on the quality of your products.
And listeners, if you're one of those percentage of the population that never tried passion fruit, get some of this stuff. I mean, it's really wonderful. And I don't think you really need to add sugar to it. You can always, I think to me, a little rum mixed in with it might be really delicious.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Rum works. Yeah.
Well, everything's working for you, Auntie Lily, and thank you so much for joining us today. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Okay, Lori.
Thank you so much for having me.
And if passion fruit is a passion in Hawaii, guess what's a passion throughout all of these United States? What is almost everybody's favorite dish that their grandmother or their mother or their auntie used to cook for them? You'll have to wait to find out until after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. The answer to the question, of course, is fried chicken.
Yeah, every time I see this, I laugh because of a subject typo in our email list with the publicist. It said the book's real name, which is Fried and True, somebody started Fred Chicken.
It was me. I said, isn't this book called Fred Chicken?
Well, it was actually in the title, the subject line.
Was it? Okay.
But I laugh about that. But Lee Brian Schrager is really an extraordinary person. I mean, he does so much. I don't know how he does it all. But he's done a fine job on describing all the many ways you can deal with America's, as you said, favorite food. Lee Schrager, we have a little inside joke that I'm going to tell you.
Okay. Is
one of your earlier publicists had a typo in her subject line, and instead of saying fried chicken, she had Fred Chicken.
Peter, Fred must have loved that.
So Peter thought, really, we were talking about Fred Chicken.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, I actually thought that was the title of your book, and I was thinking, boy, what a clever title that is.
Not clever. That may be book number two, Fred. Or it could be Fred's Fried Chicken.
It's smarter than Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Exactly. Oh, that's so funny.
Anyhow, well, you said this writing a book on fried chicken was not actually on your bucket list, but you really got encouraged by how well this one went. And it's something, isn't it?
Not surprising. I mean, when you think of great food today and great American comfort food, like barbecue and burgers and pizza, fried chicken, has always been on top of my list. And it's really nice to see the bird getting the attention it really deserves.
Read some survey, I don't remember who, said that finally, just now, fried chicken has surpassed the burger as America's favorite food.
You know, that's interesting. I wouldn't think so. I mean, clearly, I think a burger is more popular. I mean, but listen, I certainly hope it's fried chicken. Certainly, we're fried and true out tomorrow, so I'm hoping it is fried chicken. It'd be good for the book. But, burger, pizza, taco, I've been successful with our events, with single subject events like these. And to me, it's always been on top of the list.
The funny thing about it is that overseas, especially I think, maybe it's just because we just got back from England, fast food chains are dominated by KFC.
Well, KFC's been around for a long time, and they do great fried chicken. It's still one of my favorites,
Yeah, me too.
After, even after traveling across the country, I still love a good KFC fix every once in a while.
Yeah, I used to live on buckets of the stuff until one of the somebody I know was a nursing student found a mouse deep fried in her bucket of chicken.
Well, that would be enough to turn me off of it. But to date, I've had lots of KFC, and there's not been anything in there but great fried chicken.
She got
Hold on a minute. She got the variety pack.
clearly, I wonder if that comes with extra. What type of hot sauce that comes with?
Tell me this, Lee. Tell us how you organized this. I mean, the introduction was really cute by Whoopi Goldberg. And you tied it in, of course, to the your food and wine festival, the South Beach Food and Wine Festival special events. But how did you set off? I mean, have you always, your whole life, been cataloging in your brain different favorite fried chicken places and recipes?
No, I have to say that really, I mean, I really was honest when I wrote that I never planned on writing a book, another book, let alone a fried chicken book, but when the idea was brought to me, and it really happened a few years ago at the Food Network South Beach Wine and Food Festival in 2013, and we were at an event that we do each year for Tricia Yearwood.
Oh, yeah.
And Tricia and I were talking about our love for fried chicken, because it was a great chef doing fried chicken in her brunch. And we were talking about fried chicken, and kind of out of nowhere, my publisher from Clarkson Potter, who did my first book, you know, and also does Tricia Yearwood's books, came up to us and heard the conversation, and she said to me jokingly, or I thought jokingly, that I should really entertain a book on fried chicken.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of laughed it off, and a few weeks later, Pam Krause followed up with me and said, hey, I'm really serious. I'd love you to do a book on fried chicken. And that's how it came about.
Okay, and it's called Fried and True.
Fried and True. It is indeed called that. It's more than 50 recipes for America's best fried chicken and some great side dishes as well.
Yes, lots of sides.
I still think it should be called Fred Chicken.
Fred's Fried Chicken, exactly.
Anyhow, Lee, now you were a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America.
I am. I graduated. I don't want to tell you how long ago, but I did graduate in 1979, so it's been quite a while.
It has been a while. But, I mean, did you work in restaurants? Or?
Well, I did, actually. I worked when I was at the Culinary Institute of America. I actually worked at Tavern in the Green, which, as you probably know, just reopened in New York City. So it was nice to go to the opening a few weeks ago in New York.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd always worked in restaurants. Growing up as a young child, my earliest jobs were working in the industry. I worked at a Chinese restaurant. I worked at a movie theater. I worked at a Swenson ice cream parlor. I've done everything. I mean, from valet parking to room service waiter, you name it, I've done it in this industry.
Now,
but then you sort of changed direction.
I changed direction. Actually, it really, my career kind of blossomed when I was working for Omni Hotels many years ago. I worked at a property in Fort Lauderdale at an Omni Hotel, and I was a room service midnight graveyard shift manager, which meant not only did I take the order, but many times I cooked it and delivered it. And it was really at that hotel, kind of watching the events taking place, you know, that would be going on the weekends and the black tie galas and the big charity events, that my love of event planning really came about. And when the opportunity arose while working there one night and the catering director kind of stormed off property, I really seized the opportunity and said, I can do that. And that's kind of the beginning of my career.
Interesting.
Now there's somewhere down there, whether it's in Miami or Fort Lauderdale, I can't remember which, where there's an Omni Hotel and there's a Marriott Hotel almost exactly next door.
Actually, it's Fort Lauderdale, and there's a Marriott, a Grand Marriott, and there's a Hyatt. I mean, listen, like Miami, Fort Lauderdale, anywhere in South Florida has really come into its own, and it's a big market, certainly a big tourism market.
Now, I wanted to tell you, if it was the same place, I wanted to tell you a really funny story, because I was attending, this is 25 years ago at least, I was attending a big nationwide conference put on by IBM, which was taking place at the Omni. But my plane got delayed somewhere, and I arrived at the Omni at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and they tried to tell me I didn't have a reservation. So
I love when that happens.
Yeah, so I proved to them that I did, and I got the bridal suite. But there was a guy from IBM who arrived later than me, and they truly had no rooms left at the Omni. So he got the JW Marriott's suite at the Marriott.
Oh, that's so funny.
Which has a grand piano in it, among
other
things.
Oh, my God, that's funny. Well, I hope it came with a bride.
No, I didn't get a bride, but they ran out of meeting rooms, and I was able to volunteer my suite to have a meeting.
Listen, I have a question. Your dedication here is to my parents, Ken and Marlene Schrager, who recognized early on that being different is sometimes better. Tell me about that.
Well, I think it really pertains to that growing up as a child, I wasn't interested in workshop or I wasn't interested in sports, and I always had a interest in the culinary field. And my parents encouraged it. You know, I was different from my older brothers, and they encouraged it, and they encouraged each of their kids that we could all do anything we wanted, and we should just love what we do, and that's what my parents encouraged from, you know, childhood.
Now, what exactly should a reader who buys this book expect to find in it?
Well, not only 50-plus great fried chicken recipes, some spectacular photography by Evan Sung, who did all the photography from the book, some great beauty shots from the many road trips that we took in preparing this book, and really some funny stories along the way. And I believe that every chapter has a great introduction to the food of that region. And in the back of the book is a master frying chart that really breaks everything down into timing and ingredients needed. It's kind of almost like a cheat sheet for frying. And I think that's one of the great standouts of the book.
Yeah,
so not only
tips.
Is it a cookbook, it is a storybook. It's beautiful photography. You know, I think it's the ultimate host gift for whether it's Father's Day or any summer house guest you may be having, or he may be coming to stay with you, should be bringing you that book.
Now, who knew that the United States is approximately the same shape as a chicken?
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean,
isn't
that funny? We didn't know that until we were doing it. But,
I love it. Absolutely love it.
And I'm a geographer with a master's degree, and I never saw it before until I saw it in your book.
Explain
that. Oh, that's so
that.
Funny. I it's amazing how versatile that chicken is.
I mean, let's explain that to our listeners who aren't seeing this. It's actually a map of the United States sort of superimposed over the image, a silhouette of a chicken. And you have identified the contributors of the recipes in the forthcoming chapter by little stars and the dashes with their names, and geographically have assigned them there, and then you list. And the people you have are just absolutely amazing. Gavin Kaysen, Michelle Bernstein, Blackberry Farm, Wiley Dufresne, Marcus Samuelson. And then earlier on you have Thomas Keller's famous buttermilk fried chicken. You have so much back to this. And you have all these great funky recipes that you found along your road trips.
Well, I think that was the beauty of the road trip. You know, we had a list that went when we started, and every time we went to a restaurant to try a great fried chicken and we met with the chef or we met with the owner, we heard another fried chicken story. We went to this restaurant and we heard where he learned to make it, or we were trying great fried chicken at this restaurant in Atlanta and the waitress told us of her fried chicken. So we checked everything that we possibly could check out. We really looked for recipes that were geared towards the home cook. And it's just amazing when you look at 54 or 55 recipes, how different they all are, but all sharing that basic ingredient of a great piece of chicken, you know, great chicken, oil, and a dredge or brine.
You do not only the great chef's recipes, you do Southeast Asian recipes. You have Charlie Fan in here.
Well, it's global. We have Del Talde's Kung Pao chicken wings from the Pacific Northwest. We have Yotam Ottolenghi's chicken from his restaurant, Ottolenghi, in London. Yeah. Really all over. I have to say that we really made an effort to get chicken. You know, we have a great Cuban recipe from Versailles Restaurant in Miami Beach. We have, in Miami. We have another Vietnamese restaurant in Miami, Hai Vong. So although people think of chicken as being regional and being just from the U.S., clearly, you know, if you look, read the book, it came over from Scotland in the 1700s.
You know, why is that? I was really startled by that. Why would they?
So was I. And I don't know why that was. But it came over from in the 1700s. The Scottish brought it to the south. And obviously, it made its way into the hands of the slaves and the migrant workers in the south. And it became something that they all interpreted their own way with different seasoning and different spices and brining or not to brine. And, you know, the simplest of recipe, the same recipe can taste so different just by the seasoning that you're applying to it or the ingredient that you're using to fry it in.
This was another eye-opener. Well, I use that term loosely here. You are a devotee of Popeye's fried chicken, and also, it turns out, Wiley Dufresne is too. And so his recipe tries to simulate the Popeye version.
He did a good job, I have to tell you. And I didn't know going into this book that Wiley shared a common love for Popeye's fried chicken. But I heard about it, and we checked it out. And not only does he share a love for it, but he actually served Popeye's at his wedding.
Yeah, you said that, and I didn't know that either.
I didn't know that, and I will tell you, and we were so thrilled when he agreed to kind of make up that Popeye's, and I will tell you, it's pretty darn close. It's as close as it gets.
Another thing probably a lot of people don't realize, when you talk about your devotion to Hojo's, Howard Johnson's, and their fried chicken, it turns out few people know this, but that was like the first job, not the first job, but it was an early job run by Jacques Pepin had, held by Jacques Pepin.
Well, Jacques was the original corporate chef for Howard Johnson.
Yeah.
I mentioned in the book how much I loved Howard Johnson's growing up as a young child. And how we used to go there on Friday nights for the all-you-can-eat fried chicken festivals that they did until we were asked to leave because we ate too much chicken.
Yeah, how could they do that? I thought that was an injustice.
Well, you know, it was straight. You know, it was early humiliation being tossed out of a Howard Johnson's. But I'm glad that, you know, we have Jacques Pepin's recipe in the book, which is the original fried chicken recipe.
Right. This other one looks pretty good too, from the Carboni.
Carbone's fantastic. I mean, that is I think it's a fried chicken cacciatore.
Fried
chicken cacciatore. Pretty spectacular.
Looks it.
Yep.
Now, what about, when you have Leah Chase, which is, she's one of my favorite people. Yeah, me too.
Really one of my favorites and one of the loveliest people.
Isn't she sweet? Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. And then you have sides. Talk to us about some of the sides.
Well, the sides to me are some of the favorites, my favorites in the book, you know, because I think that every great fried chicken recipe deserves a great side. And we have some spectacular side dishes. We have some wonderful biscuits. We have a wonderful creamy polenta. We have a great tomato pie, a hash brown casserole. We have fried green tomatoes. So I would say the sides to me are as important because they complement and finish off some great fried chicken.
See, I never had a tomato pie.
Oh, it's fantastic. And the secret ingredient in that tomato pie is Ritz crackers.
Yeah, I read that. I wasn't quite sure about that one.
I will tell you, the first time I had that at Mary Mac's in Atlanta, I tried it, and I couldn't. I said, I know that taste. What is it? And it was Ritz crackers. It's really so wonderful.
Well, I mean, I think this is just absolutely, it's a surprising book, a delightful surprise. In all your recipes and the thoughtful stories you put in. And the photography really gives you, it draws you into the whole spirit of the thing. Ultimately, what do you think is the one big attraction for fried chicken?
The one big attraction for fried chicken? God, it's iconic American comfort food. And I think what I like most about fried chicken to me is that it kind of epitomizes the beginning of summer. So when I think of Memorial Weekend coming up this weekend, I think of fried chicken, great watermelon salad, and I just think of really how many ways there are to make great fried chicken, and really how simple it is. So if you can follow a recipe, you can read, you can make fried chicken at home.
Yes, and with all your tips, it's almost foolproof. Well, Lee, I really wish you great success with this book because I think that everybody should take a look at it and see the possibilities for this iconic comfort food.
Appreciate it. Fried and True is out tomorrow, May 20th, and available on Amazon or on Fried and True Cookbook. And I thank you for coming on your show. It was such great fun to speak with you, and I'm going to think about a Fred's Fried Chicken book for number 2.
You can also, by the way, get it on the bookshelf on OTM.
We have it listed on
themenuradio.com. At least you will after we finish this interview.
I'll look forward to it, and I look forward to meeting you guys and have you back down in South Beach, I hope.
Great.
Thank you so much, Lee. You're a true American hero.
Thank you for that.
Carry on.
Bye, guys. Nice speaking with you.
You too, Lee. Bye-bye.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Now, there's a man who likes his fried chicken. And after the break,
and his name isn't even Fred.
Yeah, right. And after the break, we're going to have someone who likes to do something that seemed to us at first sight to be somewhat redundant.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
It's not too often that I invite the cookbook authors to come live with me, but this book is so delicious. The Homemade Flour Cookbook, that I made this invitation to Erin Alderson, and she hasn't actually replied, but I think you're not probably going to do that, right, Erin?
Yeah, probably.
The deal is, unfortunately, that if she goes and does that for somebody, she gets captured and she never escapes alive.
I think my husband might be a bit disappointed with that.
Yeah, but she becomes a cooking slave forever.
I bet he loves this experimentation. How long have you been doing this?
For about 3 or 4 years now.
Wow. So he's got to taste a lot of really yummy stuff.
Oh, definitely. I think probably more than his fair share.
Well, you have a blog called Naturally Ella, and Ella is, you said, your initials.
Correct.
I still don't see that Ella. ELLA is what initials? Erin?
Erin Louise Lindeen Alderson.
Okay, all right, okay. See, and if you go on her blog site or website, everybody, you'll find out that that's what it is. Tell us what your premise is here. You want us all to start milling our own flour, huh?
Mm-hmm. So I started the blog as a way of kind of sharing recipes and really moved into the area of whole foods and eating a lot of unprocessed foods and creating these recipes based around those foods. And it started out with kind of a love of fresh fruits and vegetables, which kind of morphed into using a lot of whole grains and legumes and keeping nuts and seeds around the house. And so I had this pantry full of all of these different items, and I was lucky enough to receive a grain mill for one of my, I think, birthdays. And all of a sudden, it felt like a completely different world had opened up, because I realized that all of these things I had already had in my kitchen could serve a second purpose through grinding.
Oh, wow. Now, you had very bad eating habits as a child, but then you had an awakening when your father had a heart attack. Is that correct?
That is correct. He had a heart attack at the age of 45, which
That's
kind
not
of
good, yeah.
woke us all up.
Yeah, I would say. So, but this is sort of just a natural extension of your belief in whole foods.
It really is. And I tend to share a lot of different recipes on the site, and so this book does feel exactly like an extension of all of the recipes I already share, and it was fun to be able to really focus on the different flours.
Right. Now, you do what is required to do for something that's really not commonplace. You go through the list of equipment that you can use or that you will need for mm-hmm. home milling, and I was rather surprised that you could bake things into flour in your food processor.
Yeah, the specifically, the food processor is really good for nuts and seeds because the grain mill can't, especially the electric grain mill, can't process those because of the oils. And so the food processor is really good for those. My favorite one is using a coffee grinder for really small batches is great because it's something that's cheap and can get people milling flour pretty easily.
And that's certainly small, though. I mean, you can't do any major project with that.
Right.
Yeah.
You also need a clean coffee grinder.
You do. Yeah, I bought a separate one because I love my coffee as well. So.
Now, if you said the grain mill will do some but not all, but presumably a coffee grinder will do some but not all as well, right? The some but all being quantity.
But yeah, in quantity, definitely. It's really good for kind of smaller batches, a half cup of flour, a cup of flour here or there. It can also overheat pretty quickly, but small batches and small, like if you use it for about 5-10 seconds and then sift the flour and then go back. It's definitely not the most convenient way, but it's, like I said, a very cheap way for people to kind of dip their toe in the water.
Well, now you've been doing this for a long time, and you have learned on the job, so to speak, about all the requirements in terms of quantity, which you highly recommend doing in terms of weight, which is true of just about everything anymore. And you explore all these different grains. Could you run us through some of these? I mean, I'm looking at some that we might know, this barley, rye, wheat, of course. You even do different kinds of wheats and wheat berries. But then there's some others that people may not know as well, such as kamut, is it?
Kamut.
And what, tell us what kamut is.
Kamut's just essentially another type of wheat that is, it's actually a trademark type of wheat that has very specifics of what it is. It's an organic grain, it's a certain purity, it's grown in certain regions, and has a little bit sweeter flavor than the traditional wheat berry.
What about emmer?
Emmer is another type of ancient wheat, again, kind of the same, similar to kamut, where it has specifics that it had not been bred with another type of wheat. All of these, in emmer is within the same family as spelt and einkorn, and so all of these different types of wheats are grown in various areas throughout the world and have very specifics on how they're grown and what makes them that particular type of grain.
Now, have you read The Third Plate yet?
I have.
And what about the, I mean, that was a shocker to me about how it used to be a perennial crop, wheat.
Yeah, it's always a little bit eye-opening.
It's what?
Eye-opening to when you hear about things like that.
Yeah, I mean, we've wrecked the whole thing. I mean, oh, well. Okay, so now we're into this other area here called gluten-free grains. Tell us about teff, amaranth, quinoa, and you do some wonderful things with sweet rice, which is, I think you need to do some explaining to our listeners about all these.
Okay, so obviously it seems gluten-free is a buzzword in today's media, mm-hmm. and I personally, I eat all the grains and everything, but I really love some of the different flavors that come along with these gluten-free grains. Amaranth is actually, while we consider it a grain, it's actually a really small seed, but it cooks like a grain and it grinds like a grain, and so we use it as a grain. That's the same with quinoa as well. It's actually a seed, but is considered a grain. And these different types of grains have really pronounced flavors and can be used in a lot of fun ways.
Corn section was surprising to me.
Mm-hmm. I always have popcorn kernels around the house to pop on the stove because that's one of my husband's and I's favorite snacks. And so when I realized that I could grind it pretty much like anything else and come up with something that was akin to polenta, it was really fun to play around with.
Now, you may, if you're so crazy about popcorn, want to come live with us anyhow, because I'm working on the Fancy Food Show, the Summer Fancy Food Show, and all the samples I've been getting are popcorn. I mean, everybody's making popcorn.
That sounds wonderful.
I mean, kale popcorn. You can't beat it, can you? So, anyhow, okay, so then you move on. Oh, I wanted to stay here. Do you know that in southwestern Pennsylvania, just across into West Virginia, every year when I was growing up, they had a buckwheat festival?
Interesting.
Wasn't that funny? Oh, yeah, it was strange. Okay, so then you go into lovely legumes. Now, this is where I really fall in love with your recipes. Tell us about chickpeas, lentils, black beans, white beans. I love them. Go ahead.
So when I first started playing around with gluten-free baking and cooking, it was actually I was working for a bakery that had built a devoted kitchen for gluten-free baking, and a lot of the recipes we were making were using chickpea garbanzo bean flour. And so that was my introduction into the idea that I could use bean or legume flour as something else in baking and cooking. And so I've been kind of experimenting and grinding different ones, and while chickpea flour is one of the more ones that you can readily get in the grocery store, I've actually fallen in love with black bean flour. I think that the flavor is nice, and it can really create some fun meals.
Yeah, well, I'll go along with that one. And, there's one I just passed by here. Peter is a master latke maker, and you have a recipe here that you're going to have to try, radical. It's chipotle sweet potato latkes with cilantro dip.
Mm-hmm. And I think that one's made out of the red lentil flour, I believe. Is that correct?
I'm just checking that out here. Sweet potatoes, pistachio meal.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that maybe that's a nut one. That might be the pistachio one.
Oh, it is.
One.
It's in the nut section, yes. And here's a photograph. Look at them. Isn't it gorgeous?
Yeah. Funnily enough, I read a recipe the other day for carrot latke.
Yeah.
They read pretty well, too. I mean, I never even thought about it, but I suppose there's no reason why you can't make latke with turnips or with rutabagas or just about anything. Just about anything that you can get the same texture as you can by, what's the word I'm looking for? Not grinding.
Grating.
But if you can grate it, you can make it into latkes.
I've seen a lot of different unique combinations for that.
I'll have to try some of that.
Our grandkids are coming to visit.
Yeah,
I'm not going to volunteer.
I'm sure I'll be asked. So I'll just wait till somebody asks me. I'm not going to volunteer. When we go south to see them to South Carolina, I have to pack my grater and take it along in the suitcase because there's no way to produce enough latkes. Unless you have a professional quality grater.
It just
takes too long.
Now, another nut that's really an increased popularity at this point is hazelnut. And you have some pretty good recipes for hazelnuts, like hazelnut crusted goat cheese salad. Now, that's pretty mm-hmm. cool. And hazelnut dark chocolate truffles. Well, that's a classic practically, right?
Yeah, that one is more, that's one of my favorite recipes and one I've actually been making before I started really getting into grinding flours, but I figured it was kind of a fun, easy dessert to include in the book.
I mean, what is your favorite grain or nut or seed to work with?
It's kind of hard to pull out a favorite because I really love all of the unique flavors and textures that the different grains and legumes and the nuts and seeds provide. My husband is partial to pistachios, and
me
so
too.
Pistachio meal and flour is kind of a lot of fun to work with because he gets excited about it as well.
Well, just as a singular reference here to a recipe to show or to demonstrate to our listeners how unique your recipes are, I hit upon this one, which I just couldn't even believe. I love it. Again, I want you to come. Pecan-crusted green tomato sandwiches.
Mm-hmm.
Run us through that one.
So I take the pecan meal, and essentially bread the green tomato slices as you would traditional fried green tomato slices, and fry them up, and the pecan meal creates a really nice crust on the green tomatoes.
But you don't stop there. I mean, you bring in the fresh herbs, including mm-hmm. dill, sea salt. The buttermilk goes where?
That's part of the dressing. So the sandwich itself is the green tomatoes have the pecan meal, a little bit of salt and pepper, and then I dress up and I make it a sandwich with a little bit of dressing, with a chipotle ranch dressing.
Well. Stunning recipes, I must say. The Homemade Flour Cookbook by Erin Alderson. And Erin, what did you do as a day job before you did this?
I was actually a music professor at a small liberal arts college in Illinois.
Really? And what
I was.
Like, what did you teach? Do you have an instrument or a voice?
I was the instrumental director, and I did the marching band and the concert band and taught classes. But my primary instrument is bassoon.
I'll be darned. See, you are kind of an oddball, aren't you?
Yeah.
In a wonderful way, I might add.
Oh, thank you.
Well, it's been a delight, and this cookbook's a revelation, and I think everybody should get a miller so you can mill your own flours in your kitchen.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, well, enjoy yourself and continued success to you.
And that's all we have for this week. We hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll join us again same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.